Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 3rd of August, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, returning after our summer break last month. It's been nearly, it has been 4 weeks, Phil. What have you been up to?
I've been enjoying the weather. I did have a week away last week in Suffolk, which is absolutely splendid.
Good, yeah.
Saw lots of posters saying it's not too late to stop Sizewell C. No to Sizewell C. We don't want traffic here.
Oh, really?
There was a lot of that going on in the neck of the woods where I was. I was just north of the of Sizewell. Beautiful village of Southwold. I've not been there before. Highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. But don't go when I'm there, otherwise you'll all be there at once. No, lovely. How about you? You been away at all?
I had a long weekend camping down in Cornwall. Which was nice, right at the very end of that very hot period. It was rather uncomfortable. We were in a jet black camper van. Ooh. But actually it wasn't too bad. It was relatively comfortable. But then it started raining, so we came home. So I cut that short. So just been pottering around in the garden, trying to keep it from going brown ever since. Yeah, so I think we've already touched on the main theme of this week's conversation, which of course is the question of energy and climate, because certainly, I mean, nobody could have avoided noticing the record temperatures which were achieved, certainly up in the eastern side of the country a few weeks ago. And of course, this is all down to global warming, we're being told, and that we have to reconsider things like nuclear power in order to wean ourselves off fossil fuels and compensate for the lack of renewables while we're still developing that. So it's very much the main topic of conversation at the moment, I think, is energy cost and the lack of energy and the effects of generating energy. It's what everybody's talking about. And of course, it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good, of course, Phil, because the energy companies are doing extremely well out of this, aren't they?
Well, there was the news yesterday that BP had, in just 3 months, in the was it the quarter, April to June, had made £7 billion profit before tax. Underlying profit, a big pun, that figure. £7 billion in 3 months. I mean, it's a big company, yeah. BP, and it's a national treasure, and we want it to do well. What's not widely reported, actually, it lost even more than that in the previous quarter, I believe. I might need to check that up. But yeah, it does raise the whole question of how can the government, it looks like it's going to be Liz Truss at the moment. That's the other big story that's been going on the past few weeks while I've been away.
I've forgotten about
what's
that.
What's the next Prime Minister going to do about these rising energy prices? Rishi Sunak talked about having a windfall tax on the energy companies, and that he's backtracked from that. I think it's academic what he thinks now. I don't think he's going to get the job by everything I read.
No, it doesn't look like it.
And Liz Truss certainly is philosophically against windfall tax, positioning herself as a hardline right winger. Yeah. I mean, we'll come on to talk about energy generation, but the cost of energy is such a big issue for all of us, because of our heating, electricity and gas bills, mm-hmm. we know have gone up hugely and are going to go up even more over the winter when we start putting our central heating back on and so on and so forth, and having our lights on from 4 or 5 o'clock in the day instead of late on in the day. So every one of us is facing these huge rising bills. And of course, the construction industry is rising. The energy cost, the input cost, is a huge factor in tender price inflation, and a lot of clients are going, oh, if that's the price, then local authorities say that they've got a budget of whatever it might be, £10 million or £1 million or £100 million to fill in potholes, and they thought they'd be able to fill in X potholes with that pot of money, and now they're only going to be able to fill in, you know, 80% of X or half X number of potholes with that amount of money. So there's going to be less work for the construction industry because of these rising energy prices. I think that's inevitable.
Well, yeah, that's true. Although you passed on to me only this morning a press release about what Birmingham is doing to try and retrofit energy efficiency measures into its housing stock. And there seems to be no shortage of funding for that.
Well, let me tell you, this was, I mean, it's not an extraordinary story, but the number's extraordinary. To the extent that it's Equans is the contractor. This is the company which is currently part of Engie, or Engie, if we're French, but is in the process of being acquired by Bouygues. And I got sent this press release by them saying they've got a contract to modify 300 council homes in Birmingham to make them more energy efficient and less reliant on fossil fuels, the whole decarbonisation thing. And there's lots of...
This is a pilot project, isn't it?
Yes, but it's the initial project, 300, is to work out what works best, to test different approaches for fixing up houses and then to roll, you know, use that learning to roll it across their stock of 60,000 properties across the city. So I emailed Equans rather back, and I said, what's the value of this contract? And said, £27 million. So I said, well, I assume that's not just the pilot, that's for the whole 60,000 properties across the city. I said, no, that's just for the pilot. And I went, but that's 90 grand per house. And Birmingham council houses might be quite splendid, but they're not all, you know, like Oxford council houses, Headington Hall, where Robert Maxwell lived. I mean, 90 grand, I would have thought, I mean, I know I could do an awful lot to my house with 90 grand. It seemed, it seems a vast sum of money. And I said, are you sure? I said, no, that's just for the 300 homes that we're going to do, you know, retrofit, put some insulation in, maybe a bit of double glazing and then heat pumps instead of gas boilers and this sort of stuff. And they said, and it's 27 million. So, yep. So you have to think, whatever you do to a Birmingham council house, I reckon you could do all sorts of clever stuff and reduce those energy bills from, I don't know, what would they be? £3,000 a year? I mean, maybe £5,000 if you're really extravagant. And you might be able to halve them or even a quarter them. But you're still talking about something like a 25-year, more probably like a 50-year or even 90-year payback if you're going to spend 90 grand per house with the purpose of reducing energy bills. And that's before they come on to the other 59,700 properties. I mean, I'm just going to do a quick get my calculator out and do 60,000 times 90,000. And you don't need a calculator for that sum, do you, David?
It's a no. it's a mind-boggling number. I can't do it mentally.
My calculator on my phone comes up with it. Yes, it's too big a number, but lots of millions. I mean, gazillions.
Well, if they're planning to spend 90 grand improving the energy efficiency of these 300 houses, my guess is what they're going to be doing is knocking them down and building brand new passive house homes, which will, of course, be probably the most efficient way of achieving it. But I guess, you know, that's I'm being flippant, but I suppose that it's a pilot program and they will be trialing a whole, you know, a whole variety of different technologies and different measures and stuff like that. And so, you know, there'll be no economies of scale. Everything will be sort of a one-off.
Yes.
I don't know if they'll have 300 one-offs, but I guess that basically it's going to be far more expensive than it would do once they found their preferred solution and rolled it out over the 60,000 houses in the scheme. But even so, it seems to me that it's still going to be far more expensive than most people would imagine it would be. And that if they've got a budget of 27 million for this, I've no idea what their budget would be for the whole 60,000.
There is if you've been reading the papers about the Conservative Party leadership debate, there is a bit of a lot of a right-wing backlash against the whole net zero agenda.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, construction industry is full square for it because it sees lots of work and opportunity. That's a cynical me. The other side of it is because it actually believes in climate change and believes that it's needed. I mean, you know, there's more than business reasons to support net zero. But it's hitting political headwinds. And I think if you're the next prime minister wanting to stop spending so much money, I mean, yes, there are woke awareness training courses that you might want to scrap in the civil service, but I think you'd get more money if you said to Birmingham City Council, could you not fix up 300 houses for a bit less than £27 million, please? And I think they ought to be able to manage it.
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, there has been, you're quite right, there has been quite a lot of talk from right-wingers in the Conservative, and not just the Conservative Party, but, you know, sort of journalists and other commentators about the cost of net zero. And it is it's a serious issue because I don't know if it has been properly costed. I know that a lot of people say that the government and various government advisors have plucked figures out of the air in order to justify the measures that they're taking, and you know, hitting this 2050 target of net zero is a pie in the sky, according to a lot of people. And in fact, I think there's probably quite a lot to be said for that approach, because I would be very surprised, put it this way, if we did achieve net zero by 2050, because it's a massive and massively complicated target and very difficult to quantify, especially this far in advance. And if we were to draw a comparison between that, for example, and any of the major infrastructure projects that we've developed over the past few generations, most notably at the moment, something like HS2 and Hinkley Point and stuff like that, we know that big infrastructure projects go over budget and they break their deadlines. I see absolutely no reason why we would be able to, given the current spending, be able to hit the 2050 net zero target. I think it's just not going to happen. And I think that that's because people just don't know how much all this is going to cost.
I think I said before that while I think it's not just good but essential that we do address our carbon emissions for all sorts of reasons, but for the planet primarily, this fixation on zero or net zero, I mean, of course, net zero just means planting trees when you talk about net zero, but the absolutism, I mean, if we've already brought it down huge amounts, we're going to, you know, get rid of all petrol and diesel burning cars and all driving electric cars and all these other things, does it matter that we have a little bit of pollution, a little bit of carbon? Can't the atmosphere, can't the universe or the earth, the organic system of the earth, cope with that? I mean, on a slight tangent, James Lovelock passed away the other day.
The Gaia man.
The man who came with the Gaia theory, that the earth, theory being that the earth is an... I don't think it's actually, I haven't read it, I've only read about it. I don't think it's actually a living organism or analogous to a living organism that sort of changes and responds to what's going on, hence global warming and so on. But if the Gaia theory is right, I would have thought that the Earth could cope with it can't cope with all the horrible stuff we've been chucking at it for the past 100 years, but a little bit, can't it cope with that? I mean, do we have to be...
Well, this is another thing, because we tend to, in order to try and understand these issues, we tend to simplify them in order to make them digestible in a way. And I think when you talk about, you know, saving the planet isn't at risk, it's us and some of the other organisms that are at risk. I mean, the planet will just carry on doing its own thing. I mean, just given, you know, the effect of tectonic plate movements over millennia, soon the solid ground that you and I are sitting on at the moment is going to be buried under new ground, because everything goes around and comes around. And you only have to look at geological upheavals in the cliffs locally where I live, and you can see where ancient historic sea beds have been tipped on end, and everything's been The world will carry on. The Earth will carry on, at least for another few billions of years.
But isn't the only reason to care about the Earth is because of its ability
to sustain life of
humankind and flora and fauna.
Yeah.
If you can't do that, we might as well stop caring about the planet.
Yeah, I guess so. Yes, I suppose. Obviously, we're trying to prevent climate disasters, aren't we? Flooding and extreme weather conditions and that kind of thing. That's what it's all about, and species loss. But again, because it's so complicated, I think that it's too easy to oversimplify things and say it's like the Just Say No campaign. Is it just say no?
You're talking about drugs?
Zero oil?
I thought you were talking about Grange Hill's ammo saying just say no to drugs.
No, I don't. I've probably got the wrong campaign. But it's the current campaign to say no to oil.
Say no to oil and glue yourself to a painting.
Yeah. Yeah, using glue that's made out of hydrocarbons, you know? I mean, you can't just say no. I mean, if you were literally to give up anything that is created by the oil industry, you'd end up living in a cave, quite frankly. And so the thing is, it's a gradual process. You have to wean yourself off it. And I think a lot of these people who are, as you say, absolutist about it, are completely missing the big picture. They're focusing on far too smaller an aspect of the debate and missing the point in many ways. But getting back to this question of the cost of net zero, another press release which came in, I think we both received it yesterday, from an organisation that I'm not familiar with, actually. It's the Energy and Utilities Alliance, the EUA, which I think obviously represents a trade association which represents, I guess, the utilities industry, so the generators and the distributors of energy. They've done a bit of research, which might be slightly biased given their remit, about the opening sentence of the press release is: evidence of heat pump costs for French consumers blows a hole in the UK government policy, a leading energy trade body has claimed. Quote Mike Foster, who's the chief executive of the EUA. He says that current government policy believes heat pump costs will fall by 20 to 50% by 2025 and reach parity with gas boilers by 2030. So basically,
that's the hope. We thought it was wind power, and wind turbine costs have come down hugely.
They have. They really have. And now, at the moment, the EUA says that the average heat pump costs around £10,000 to install, whereas a combi boiler replacement is only about £1,500. So there's obviously a big disincentive to install an air source heat pump at the moment, or any type of heat pump, I guess. But anyway, they've had a look at France. Because basically, evidence uncovered by the EUA indicates heat pump installations in France average 11,000, similar to the UK. But last year, 537,000 heat pumps are sold in France compared to 50,000 units in the UK. So they're saying, basically 10 times as many heat pumps were sold in France last year as there were in the UK.
So they've got the volume, they've got critical mass.
They've got the volume, and there's no economy in numbers there because although they installed 10 times as many, the price was just the same, if not slightly more. So what Mike Foster is saying, and his colleagues at the EUA, is saying that why should we believe the government when they say that prices are going to come down by 25 to 50% within the next few years?
Oh, but David, Brexit, we're outside the EU now. It'll all be much cheaper.
Oh, of course. Oh, that's the answer. Well, clearly, it's not the answer. I'd be surprised if anybody seriously put forward that argument. But it does raise the question, why are French heat pumps so expensive to install if they're installing so many of them? There must be. If you're churning out, if a heat pump factory is churning out loads of these things, and let's face it, basically a heat pump's just a fridge in reverse. It can't be that cutting edge and expensive in terms of R&D. If they are turning out that number of them, why are they still so expensive? Is it because they're making more money out of it? Or actually, is the true cost of making and installing these heat pumps hidden and that the government is being disingenuous by telling us that the price is going to come down.
The whole heat pump thing, it's a toughie, but we know that we need to reduce our reliance on fossil fuel, not least the fact that we made a hostage of ourselves, not as much as Germany, but slight hostage to Russian gas, which we don't want to be buying anymore. You wrote something the other day about an interesting project to import energy from somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Never thought we'd import energy from.
Well, this was astonishing. This is we put this in. It's an international news story which arrived yesterday. Well, no, I posted it. Did I post it yesterday? I can't remember. But it's a fascinating story, and it really took me by surprise because I was surprised that I hadn't heard about this previously. There's a company called, and you're going to have to bear with me a second, folks, while I pull up this story because I can't remember what I've done with it.
They're either called Xlinks or Xlinks.
A company called Xlinks, which is spelt X, links, so that's quite easy to say.
But it's not Exlinks, though, is it? It's not former links.
No. It's just X. No. It's Xlinks. Xlinks. It's a fairly new company, startup. It's based in Billericay in Essex. They've got a former Tesco chief executive who's the chairman of the business. They've got fairly high caliber board. They've got this proposal, which is to build wind farms and solar farms in Morocco. And actually, if you look at a map, Morocco is not a bad place to get wind energy and solar energy because,
are the Atlas Mountains in Morocco? Is my job
they are.
Working there?
Right. But I think this development is on the coast. So it's on the Atlantic coast, so you've got plenty of wind. It's pretty reliable wind coming in off the Atlantic Ocean. And, of course, being North Africa, you've got plenty of sunshine as well most of the year. So it's a 3.6 gigawatt high-voltage direct current interconnector from this proposed development in Morocco all the way up the Atlantic coast to Biddeford in North Devon, where I live, where it's going to plug into the national grid at a little village called Alverdiscot. And I am astonished that I didn't know anything about this, having living in the area.
So, a quick question. Why would they want to go round the Lizard and up into North Devon? Why don't they just come up to, South Devon, Salcombe or somewhere?
I think, actually, when you approach the sort of Cornwall Peninsula from the Atlantic, basically you come to a fork in the road. You can go right down the south coast, or you can go left up the north coast. And really, the distance isn't all that different because you're approaching it from sort of like the Scilly Isles direction.
That's because the world is round, unlike those maps that I look at.
Exactly.
I get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. The pipeline's not a pipeline. It's a cable, or I think probably a bunch of cables. It is following the. It's following the coast, so up the coast of Africa, across to Portugal, I assume, and up Portugal, Spain, and then across the Bay of Biscay, and then nipping across the Channel and up through the Bristol Channel to Alverdiscot. It could go in a straight line and cut out the Bay of Biscay, but apparently Bay of Biscay is very deep, and they can save money by following the continental shelf and not going too deep. But it is an astonishing story. The cable.
So just let me take you back a sec. Is the solar farm and the wind farm in Morocco, do they already exist and Xlinks are just tapping into it, or are Xlinks going to build or develop the assets?
They're going to build
in Morocco.
The actual story which I posted isn't that they're going to do this. The fact is that they've appointed WSP as the technical advisor for their for the converter stations in Morocco and a lot of the infrastructure out there. It's that part of the project is about just over £1 billion, I believe. The whole project itself is that they expect it to cost about £16 billion, the entire thing. That involves obviously the manufacture and the laying of the cable and all the infrastructure at this end as well.
So that's about two quarters of BP's profits then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Drop in the ocean almost literally. But no, this, This is a 3,800 kilometer long interconnected cable. And I don't know much about subsea cables, but according to those in the know, this will be by far the longest undersea power cable in the world. I mean, we've got interconnectors which nip across the North Sea and the Channel to France and the Netherlands and wherever. And we get a lot of our energy coming across from, well, basically Calais to Dover, I think. There's a big interconnector there. All that lovely French nuclear energy coming through a subsea cable into Kent. But of course, that's only about sort of 20 or 30 kilometres. This is 3,800 kilometres going all the way up the Atlantic coast, which is an astonishing thing. I think it's great. I think the idea is wonderful. I'm a little bit nervous about the vulnerability of a subsea cable going all that way. Because after all, even though I'm sure it's extremely well made and it'll be armoured with all sorts of different layers, it's still just lying on the seabed. And I've always thought that subsea cables must be very vulnerable to things like having ships sink on them and earthquakes snap them and things like that. But obviously, we're highly dependent on subsea cables for all sorts of things. So I'm sure that's my fears are unfounded. But yeah, so all that lovely energy, which is being generated out in the Moroccan desert, is going to be piped up through Devon to the rest of to the national grid. And I think they reckon it's going to provide up to 8% of Great Britain's energy needs.
Do we know when we'll start benefiting from this project? When the energy will start coming through my plug?
The thing is, it's all at a very early stage at the moment. I mean, they've got a few million pounds of funding already. I think 30 million, I think. That's not in the story, but I read it somewhere. They've got about 30 million pounds of funding so far. But of course, for a 16 billion pound project, that's really just small change. So I guess that they're still very busy trying to drum up the rest of the funding. But I'm surprised that I did actually find, much to my shame, that there are a couple of stories in the local press, in the North Devon Journal, about this last year, and I've missed that. I obviously ought to read my local paper more assiduously, which I don't. So there has been stuff in the local press. I think there was something in the Daily Mail, but I haven't seen anything about it in the national press apart from that. I'm surprised, actually, because I think it's quite significant. If it's going to provide us with 8% of our electrical power, then it's clearly a big deal.
Well, no doubt, as it starts to move from desktop to reality, and personally I hope it does, but no doubt the local press will be giving a lot more coverage, and we'll be generating a lot of adverse excitement, shall we say, in your neck of the woods, because even though the turbines and the solar panels will be thousands of miles away in Morocco, the actual infrastructure, the building work involved where it lands in North Devon will be fairly substantial, I'd imagine.
I imagine. So apparently there is an electricity substation at Alverdiscot. I don't suppose it's really a massive one. And I don't know. A lot of in the local press, the story, which I think was posted in October last year, they did a vox pop in Alverdiscot, and they found that one or two people were very well genned up on it. They knew all about this, but they didn't want to be quoted for some reason, or didn't want to be named. Other people had no idea that it was happening. It'd be interesting to see if there is an outcry, if we're going to get sort of NIMBYs gluing themselves to the road of Alverdiscot. I don't suppose that even if they did that, many people would take notice. There's only about 250 people live in the village, and it's not on a main route anywhere, so they could glue themselves to the lane and stay there for a week or so before anybody removed them, I should think. But no, I think, clearly if they do go ahead with this, they'll have to have some sort of fairly significant infrastructure built there. I don't know why. I mean, Alverdiscot isn't actually on the coast. It's a few miles south of Barnstable and east of Biddeford, really, but it's inland. But I think there must be some sort of existing infrastructure there, which makes it a handy place to plug in. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. There is a Wikipedia page if people want to have a look at it. It's the X-Links Morocco UK Power Project, if you want to Google that. An interesting thing I notice is that one of the investors is Octopus Energy, which is a very successful, also a startup, really. I mean, they haven't been going that long. One of the sort of most high-profile and dynamic utilities companies in the UK at the moment.
Well, funny you should mention Octopus. I'd never actually heard of Octopus Energy Generation until my energy provider went belly up a year or so ago, whenever it was, and we were by default bumped over to Octopus. And I thought, well, do I need to switch? Do I want this? And they're quite highly rated, which recommend them.
Oh, yeah.
said they're good, and said, well, I'm quite a fan of Which on the whole. I use their recommendations quite a lot, so I thought, I'll stick with them. And so far, they've not been. I mean, they haven't cut my bills at all. But I wasn't expecting that. But but they respond to emails reasonably promptly with something more than a robot reply or whatever. So, but I ran a story about Octopus yesterday, actually, on the subject of energy. They do a lot of renewable energy, and they've teamed up with a Dutch wind turbine manufacturer with a plan to repower, retrofit, reboot loads of the onshore wind turbines, sort of the first generation onshore wind turbines in the UK, which are neither, sometimes not as efficient as they could be, or not as big as they could be. And they're saying, just by, there's a quote on their website saying, when it comes to wind turbine blades, size does matter. You can get 2 to 3 times more power by lengthening the blades and adjusting the tower to a more efficient structure. So they're identifying older generation of wind turbines to do that. And being quite a touchy-feely company, they're doing it very much, and they're not going to go storming in where people don't want them, and they're going to do it where people say, please come and do it here, and give some sort of local dividend. I don't know whether the local dividend is a new town hall or lower energy bills, or how it manifests itself. I think probably lower energy bills in the local area, I'm not sure. But yeah, they reckon that if the UK could upgrade just 10% of its 9,000 onshore wind turbines to get more juice out of them, you could get enough power for hundreds of thousands of homes a year, which seems remarkably sensible. I mean, refurbish and upgrade everything else in the world, so why not wind turbines?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, it does make you wonder why they didn't build them bigger in the first place, but I suppose maybe
technology didn't have them, and prices have come down.
Oh, yeah. Okay, makes sense.
And, maybe 20 years ago or whatever, the Vestas, whoever makes the blade, didn't make it. I'm making up numbers here, but didn't make a 30-metre blade. They only had a 20-metre blade.
Yeah.
For example. So there are all sorts of reasons why it might not have done. And, the whole economics and efficiency of the wind power industry has moved on in leaps and bounds since our first turbines went up.
Going off at a slight tangent here, Phil, talking about wind turbines and upgrades and the rest of it, do you remember the T-pylon? We talked about this in the past.
Yes.
There was a national competition, wasn't there, to design a new type of electricity pylon. Not strictly speaking, they're towers, not pylons. But we all know what they look like, these lattice structures standing in fields, marching across the countryside.
They've started going up in Somerset, haven't they?
Well, they have. This is what I was coming to. Because we talked about it, and I thought it looked like a very elegant design. You know, it's not this sort of rather frilly sort of lattice work. It's a sort of a monolithic, a bit like a turbine tower with a sort of a T at the top and some sort of diamond shape catenary things to hang your power lines off, and all look rather nice on the CGI, artist's impressions of what it looked like. They're now installing them. They've been doing it for a while, actually, to connect Hinkley Point C with the national grid. So they go across. Anybody going up and down the M5 will have seen them.
I believe Balfour Beatty is doing that work. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so. Yes, I think they are. So actually, around my neck of the woods, if I go, for example, to Bristol Airport, you see quite a lot of activity where they're installing these and putting in the new lines. And I have to say, I'm very disappointed.
Oh,
because
dear.
in real life, they look quite chunky and squat. And on the page, they always look rather tall, slender and elegant. And these things are, I don't think they're any less visible on the landscape than a traditional pylon. And in fact, I think I actually prefer the look of the old pylons. But there they are, they're going up, and I've no idea what other people think about them. But I when I saw the first one out of my car window, I did think that was the winner. That's not what I was expecting. But anyway, too late now. They're going up.
But I think there are an awful lot of structures around, probably around the world, but certainly around the country, where you think, I wonder what I wonder if the artist's impression that they put out at consultation looked like that.
Yeah.
And you could put together quite a probably amusing catalogue of, you know, the advertised CGI of a building or structure and how it actually looked at the end when it was built.
Well, yes, that's a good point. Who knows? But talking about Hinkley Point C would bring us on to, I mean, you mentioned Sizewell C.
Yes.
Which we haven't really, you mentioned it in passing at the beginning of the conversation. But of course, that's been in the news recently because Kwasi Kwarteng, who's the business, is he the business secretary?
Is he still? It's all changed. I think he still is for the time being. He might be Chancellor of the Exchequer before long.
Yeah, you'd have to join the queue for that job. He gave the go-ahead, didn't he? Basically, what's it called? A development consent order.
Development consent order, yes.
This is for Sizewell C.
The planning process for nationally significant infrastructure projects.
Yeah.
20th of July, we reported this, so I guess he signed it off on the 19th. What's interesting about this is that the planning inspectorate, who hold the inquiry and come up with their report and submit their recommendations to the Secretary of State, who then signs yay or nay for the development consent order, they actually recommended no. When their report they gave to the Secretary of State back in February, they said that unless the outstanding water supply strategy can be resolved, and sufficient information provided to enable the Secretary of State to carry out his obligations under the Habitats Regulations, the case for an order granting development consent for the application is not made out. In other words, they said, don't do it.
Yeah.
The Secretary of State basically said that it may be doing some damage, but we need it. The need outweighs the harms in this case, so he's going ahead with it. Now, that is not entirely surprising, but it does make me think back. Now, I can't remember. I mean, National Highways has come a cropper on this, and I can't remember whether it was Stonehenge Tunnel, the Lower Thames Crossing, or possibly even both. But on one or both of those, the planning inspectorate said, I think it's Stonehenge, the planning inspectorate. Mm-hmm. Yes, this is correct. Stonehenge Tunnel, the planning inspector recommended it didn't get development consent.
Yeah.
The Secretary of State for Transport, Grant Shapps, ignored that and said, I'm doing it anyway. And then when opponents lodged a writ legal action, the judge said, I support this. And it's all up in the air, I think. I think that's where we are with that one. The Lower Thames Crossing one never got as far as landing on the Secretary of State's desk, because the planning inspectorate immediately went back to Highways England, or National Highways as they were then. Sorry, other way around. Went back to Highways England as they were then to say, you've not done your paperwork. You've not told us enough. You've not given us enough information. So they've had to go back to the drawing board, and they haven't even submitted their revised application yet for the Lower Thames Crossing, I don't think. But the point is that when the Secretary of State goes against the planning inspectorate, it gives an awful lot of fuel to opponents to launch legal challenges, which I think in Sizewell could well be successful.
Well, if, as you say, there's clearly a lot of local objection to the project, as there's bound to be for a new nuclear power station. I'm sure there was here, but yes, absolutely. The planning inspectorate, I mean, it's an advisory group, isn't it? It's an independent organisation, and you've mentioned three projects, each of which the planning inspectorate had said, no, this isn't a good idea. And in each case, the government has said, well, thanks for your advice, but we're going to go ahead anyway. Makes you wonder, what's the point of the planning inspectorate if it's going to be completely ignored by the government at every turn? The thing about the Stonehenge Tunnel was that the pressure group, which was campaigning against the project, I think they listed 10 objections in the High Court, and the judge upheld two of them. But that was a legal challenge, and a successful legal challenge, and the government had to rethink. They were forced to, but they had to be dragged to the court in order to actually listen to what the planning inspectorate was saying. And in fact, the campaigners were saying at the time, it shouldn't be advisory, it should be binding. The government should actually listen to the planning inspectorate and follow its advice rather than just completely ignoring it.
I don't know whether I agree with that. I take the point absolutely. I might change my mind on this, but I think I disagree with that point, because when it comes to something like a nuclear power station or a new motorway or whatever, I mean, of course, they're going to be, you know, omelette and eggs and all of that. There's going to be opposition. There's going to be, you know, harms done as well as benefits. And ultimately, it's a political decision. I don't think you can objectively say, and I don't want political decisions being taken by anonymous planners who we don't vote for. I would rather political decisions were taken by politicians who stand or fall on the basis of their decisions that they take on our behalf.
Yeah, well, maybe when we got a big infrastructure project like this, we should have a referendum and see what everybody says.
That's a great idea.
It worked with Brexit, didn't it? I take your point. Yes, it is. When you get to a project of that scale, it is a political issue. And if you've, you know, if you've elected a government, you've got to give them the freedom to make political decisions, I suppose. But even so, it's interesting to see there's this sort of tension between the planning inspectorate and the government. And clearly, the planning inspectorate can obviously exert a certain amount of influence. And if it strengthens the campaigns against a project, then I suppose it is doing its job.
Yes. Well, we've gone full circle. We're back in Suffolk again.
We have indeed.
Which is where I started. Is there any aspect of energy that we should cover and haven't covered? Probably.
Almost certainly. It's a massive subject. It's a massive subject. I mean, we talked briefly about Russian gas. Russian gas, I think, actually only contributes about 5% of UK consumption. It's not massive, whereas in Germany, you alluded to this earlier, it's something like 50% of their gas comes from Russia, you know, and the Germans were very short-sighted, I have to say, because I always thought that the Russians were wrong-uns and I wouldn't have bought their bloody gas. But anyway, that's outside our remit and it's certainly beyond our control.
I do think the fact that we don't have sustainable domestic energy supply is an indictment of successive British governments over the decades.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a huge failing.
But then we had, you know, we had the prospect of self-sufficiency in North Sea gas. I mean, not coal. I think coal was definitely a busted flush, and that was going to die a death anyway. But there was more recently, of course, fracking was.
I was just about to say we haven't touched on that. Are you for or against?
Depends where you live. I mean, I've got a good friend who lives up in Lancashire who is very much against it, because that, of course, is where all the quadrilla tests were being carried out, and there's a lot of scaremongering, I have to say, about gas getting into the water supply and stuff like that. I don't think that the dangers were as bad as they were made out to be, but again, you know. What is government policy on energy? We are supposed to be moving away from fossil fuels, which is why, of course, the fracking lobby were banging their heads against a brick wall, because they were basically promoting a fossil fuel energy source, and that was well out of favour. Well, now, of course, with the Russian gas situation and Brexit and self-sufficiency and all the rest of it, there is a renewed call in certain quarters to sort of disinter the whole fracking project and see if we can't get some more shale gas out of the ground and start firing up those gas-fired power stations. It's such a complicated topic, isn't it? I mean, you know, you do need gas-fired power stations to replace the wind turbines when the wind isn't blowing. We know that. You do need something to provide a base load. And that is one of the problems with renewables. The sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time.
But the tide always turns.
The tide always turns around another one, tidal energy, which seems to be going nowhere. I don't know. I'm not sure whether I would be in favour of fracking. I might lose a friend if I said I were, but
can't afford that, can you, David?
Well, I've only got a couple.
Nonsense.
Anyway,
I'm joking.
No,
we haven't covered hydrogen either, but I think we've covered that on previous discussions.
Yeah, we have.
The one I look forward to, I've seen little bits of it, sort of demo things that you see occasionally. I think I don't know where I've seen it, but there's a technology where a billboard, an advertising hoarding, is powered by people walking on the pavement next to it.
Oh, yeah.
So I think if we can have the whole world powered by recycling the energy that people exert by tapping on their keyboards and walking to the shops or cycling around the countryside, if we can harness the natural human energy that we all expend, in my case, often needlessly and without great effect, then perhaps we could have a truly green and virtuous planet.
Yeah, well, don't hold your breath, Phil. I don't think that's going to happen just yet.
I can dream.
Good, yeah.
Right, should we call it a day? When are we next back, David? Do you think we're back in a fortnight?
Back in a fortnight's time. Yeah, so, we've had a month off, so 2 weeks and yes, we'll be back.
Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope you haven't missed us too much, but we hope you've missed us a little bit. But from David and I, thank you very much for listening to Reconstruction. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.